And good afternoon. Remember the optimism surrounding the Arab Spring less than a decade ago. But since then, the repressive policies have emerged in the region, which unfortunately now seems to include Turkey, an important U.S. ally, member of NATO, and major player in the Middle East. To help us sort this all out and what's going on in Turkey's politics and how it's affecting the broader region, and especially Turkey relations with the U.S., we are really fortunate to have Stephen Cook with us today. Stephen is a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on Arab and Turkish politics, as well as Middle East policy. He has published widely and is a frequent commentator both on radio and television. Stephen has just written a book, which I understand will be available sometime this May, called False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. Stephen has an impressive academic set of credentials, capped by a PhD in political science from the University of Pennsylvania. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Cook to the podium.
Good afternoon. It's terrific to be back here in Naples, Florida. You'll bear with me one second as I sort out my remarks from my airline reservation here. I'm not anxious to go home. Apparently, it's 25 degrees with 40-mile-an-hour wind. So it's really, really nice to be here in Naples, Florida. I hope my flight is delayed tomorrow. And it's particularly nice to be here since I know I was supposed to be here in early December, and I just want to thank the Naples World Affairs Council for being so flexible. Unfortunately, I was confronted with a family emergency that prevented me from coming down at the last minute, and I'm really glad that I was able to make the trip here in mid-February. I want to extend a very special thanks to Mimi Gregory and Bruce Hobbs for their wonderful hospitality here in making this all possible. It's also nice, I don't know where he is, I saw him before, it's good to see my old friend Earl Anderson, who honchoed my previous two trips here to Naples in the last however many years that I've been here. So it's great to see him, and it's great to see all of you here. Bruce and I look like the only two guys in a tie here. I don't know, I got the wrong memo or something. It's very unfortunate since I'm always in a tie, but I will spare you and I won't take it off now. Hopefully the evening program, people will be a little more formal. In any event, that's the end of the laughter, because I have to be honest with you, this is not an uplifting topic. Bruce, thank you for mentioning my upcoming book as well. As Bruce mentioned, today's topic is Turkey's lost democracy. But I think the question that we have to ask ourselves in thinking about what's happening in Turkey and how we've gotten to that point is whether Turkey was ever a democracy to begin with. To the casual observers of Turkish politics, it can be forgiven for thinking that Turkey's authoritarian turn or its illiberal turn in politics is a function of the failed July 15th coup d'etat, which I'm sure many of you remember, which took many of us by surprise. I was actually sitting in my home office writing an article not about Turkey but about Egypt, and I got a text message, and a friend said to me, go online and check out what's going on in Turkey. And tanks and troops in the street, I texted back. I said, that looks awfully cooey to me. That event, the failed coup, but more importantly, the subsequent purge that has been going on that has kicked thousands upon thousands of people out of their jobs, and not just military officers or police officers or civil servants, but academics, teachers, rectors of universities, soccer referees even, have been pushed from their jobs for being suspected of being part of this organization that is alleged to have masterminded the coup. This is an extraordinarily important story, but it's part of a broader story that has been going on in Turkey for the better part of the last decade. I guess I'm on the screen now, but when you came in, there was a few quotes from me as well as a really bad picture of me from when I was 50 pounds heavier. I looked like my older brother. I don't even have an older brother. That it is an extraordinary moment in Turkish politics to think that a little more than a decade ago, Turkey was invited to begin formal negotiations to join the European Union. And now Turkey looks less like a liberal European democracy, set aside the fact that there are some European countries that look less like a liberal European democracy than they did a decade ago. And Turkey looks more like a one-man elected autocracy. Indeed, since 2007, the Turkish leadership has sought to institutionalize the power of the ruling party, the Justice and Development Party, which I'll warn you, I will slip back and forth between saying Justice and Development Party and AKP, and sometimes I'll even slip into the Turkish pronunciation of it, AKP. You'll pardon me. They sought to institutionalize the power of this ruling party and, importantly, the personal power of that party's leader, who for 12 years served as the prime minister and is now the president of the country, a guy named Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Even before the coup, however, the failed coup, to be precise, even before the failed coup, President Erdogan had accumulated a significant amount of personal power at the expense of the formal checks and balances in the Turkish political system. This is, as I said, a stunning change from a country in 2002, 2003, 2004. My guess is that the first time I visited the Naples World Affairs Council was probably 2005 and 2006, and I probably extolled the fact that Turkey had undertaken extraordinary and important and wide-ranging political reforms in order to conform to the requirements of EU membership, in order to begin that membership. And it was quite a hopeful moment. Yet since 2007, Turkey has been on the opposite trajectory. The question is, how did Turkey go from being a case study in a reformist, democratizing, hopeful European Union aspirant to where it is right now, which is further away from democracy than it was even before it began those negotiations in the early 2000s? How did this happen? Well, I'm going to explain it to you in two different ways, two interrelated but different ways. One, I want to take a step back and talk about things historically, and then I want to talk about the details of what's happened between 2007 and now, February 13th, 2017. Broadly historically speaking, this is a situation that is born of Turkey's endless struggle over culture and identity. It's important to think about that, culture and identity. It's something that I call, in my own way, the Ataturk whammy. The Ataturk whammy. Ataturk, known, it was the founder of the Republic of Turkey. His real name was Mustafa Kemal. He was named Ataturk by an order of the Turkish Grand National Assembly. And he sought to change the ideals, the loyalties, the way in which Turks thought about themselves in the world. Turkey, as you all know, was born on the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious empire that spanned all the way from Europe, from the Balkans in Europe, in throughout the Mediterranean, and even as far down as the Persian Gulf. And in that Ottoman Empire, people's loyalties were to the Ottoman Caliphate, which was both the religious leadership and the political leadership. At that moment when Turkey was founded, Ataturk and his collaborators needed to find some other formula of loyalty for the people who remained in Anatolia, what we think of now as the Republic of Turkey, shorn of its imperial possessions. And that was, importantly, Turkishness. He disestablished religion, emphasized secularism. Turkey became an officially secular state in the name of progress and science, but importantly, emphasized Turkish ethnicity, that the people of Anatolia were Turkish, and that was a singular point of their identity. There was a problem with that, however. there was a whole group of other people who also lived in Anatolia who did not consider themselves to be Turks. In fact, who are not ethnically Turkish. They are Kurds. They speak a different language. They are a different ethnicity. That the demand was that they consider themselves to be Turks. In fact, for many, many years, one could not refer to these people as Kurds. They were referred to as Mountain Turks. That cultural, ethnic problem, going back to the founding of the Turkish Republic, continues to haunt Turkish politics to this day. Add to that, as I said, this disestablishment of religion, where secularism became, in addition to Turkishness, a singular point of identity in the Turkish Republic. And it's not the kind of secularism that we have here in the United States, where people can practice their religion however they please, unmolested, however they want. One of the greatest examples of this, and kind of an inspiring example of this is, I grew up in the New York area. Anybody here from the New York area? Yay, all right, New York. Okay, Yankees rule. All right. And on Fridays in New York City, I always like to watch the guys who sell kosher hot dogs on the corners. Because all those guys who sell kosher hot dogs, they're all Egyptians. They're all Egyptians. They're all from one province in Egypt called Menifee, which, by the way, is the same province that former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak is from. But that's an entirely different talk that I'll come back and talk about next year. But you have these guys on a Friday at prayer time selling the kosher hot dogs in New York City, and they roll out their prayer mats and they pray on the sidewalk. And no one actually bats an eyelash. That's kind of secularism that I think about when I think about secularism in the United States. Not the case in Turkey. Not at all the case in Turkey. In Turkey, it's closer to the French concept of laïcité. And in Turkish, they call it laïklar. Whoever's Turkish here, don't correct my Turkish. You know how hard it is for Americans to speak Turkish. And what it means is that the government controls religion in the public sphere. It ensures, it surveils the public sphere to make sure that religion doesn't enter the public sphere, the political sphere. And that has been a problem in Turkey because this top-down enforced secularization did not make sense to large numbers of Turks who were pious. Ataturk and the secular elite in Turkey had no problem with people being pious in their homes and praying and so on and so forth. But since Ataturk's death, over the course of 85, 90 years or so, this idea of secularism has been used as an anvil, again, a political anvil against people who'd like to be able to explore their religious identities in the public square in different kinds of ways. That's one big historical idea that you need to think about. This cultural issue, this ethnic, cultural, and religious issue, all rolled into one that continues to have an impact on Turkish politics. And I'll come back to it. The second thing, kind of broad idea that one needs to keep in mind, that how Turkey got to where it is now, is the paranoia of politicians. All good politicians are paranoid. Never leave, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and something else, and believe you're going to win it just because you're going to win it. You cannot take any vote for granted. And that's a good quality in good politicians and good leaders. And it is certainly a quality that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has. But he also has an additional feature of paranoia. And that is that he comes from Turkey's Islamist tradition. And over the course of many years, in particular the course of 40 years, the military has intervened in politics through coups d'etat and other means in order to prevent both Kurdish nationalism, set that aside for a second, and Islamism from accumulating power. And so Islamist politicians have been barred from politics. Their parties have been dissolved. Erdogan himself served time in jail for reciting a poem that was written not by an Islamist firebrand, but rather by one of the theoreticians of Turkish nationalism. But nevertheless, because Erdogan himself was reciting it, it was interpreted as religious incitement. The idea that Islamists and Islamist parties were centers of anti-secular activity was the reason which Islamist politicians and Islamist parties were banned over the course of many years. And the Justice Development Party, the AKP, the AKP, is the successor to a number of Islamist parties that had been closed going back 30 or 40 years. So that someone like Erdogan, despite his great success, always thinks that the next coup d'etat is under the couch or around the corner. Then the third reason, kind of broad idea, way of thinking about, of situating, of contextualizing Turkey's authoritarianism is that the current international environment is not one that favors democracy or democratization. Before anybody gets upset, that's not an observation about American politics. Right, okay. I thought that would go over better. I'm sorry. All right. It is Florida, after all. Okay. What I mean is, when you think about it, and Bruce mentioned the Arab uprisings, or what is colloquially known as the Arab Spring, that after the great moment of hopes in which Turkey was often seen as a model, there was not, once those phenomena ran into trouble, once those hoped-for democratic transitions foundered, once it became clear that Europe, the United States, President Obama was not terribly interested in promoting democracy around the Middle East like his predecessor was. In his big speech at Cairo University in June 2009, he said of 10 priorities that the United States had in the Middle East, democracy was the seventh. And he said, hey, if you all want to become a democracy, knock yourselves out. We'll help you when you become a democracy, but don't look at us. We're not going to be doing what we were doing under my predecessor. So even before this kind of what we see is this populist wave that has swept places like Poland and Hungary and Russia and Turkey, the international environment was in and of itself not favorable to democracy. Leaders in the United States and Europe and elsewhere weren't willing to invest in the success of democratic transitions in places like Turkey as well as other places. Okay, that's the three kind of broad historical contextual ideas that I want you to keep in mind as I go through what the details of what happened between 2000 and arguably 5, when Turkey began to negotiate its membership in the European Union, and where we are today. And the first thing is, in May 2007, then Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan decided that his foreign minister and a partner in founding the Justice and Development Party, a guy named Abdullah Gül, should be the next president of Turkey. The sitting president's term was coming to an end. He was an arch-secularist of the old kind of Kemalist order who had come from the Turkish judiciary. His term was coming to an end. It was time now to nominate a new president, and it was going to be this guy, Abdullah Gül, a co-founder of the Justice and Development Party, and a very nice guy, big soccer fan. And the military, which had engaged in coups d'etat in 1960, 1971, 1980, and a sort of coup in 1997, issued a statement on its website saying it did not look favorably upon Abdullah Gül for becoming the next president of Turkey, one of the reasons of which was because he's a founder of the Justice and Development Party, his wife wears hijab, and they didn't like that because the Turkish military believed that with the president of the Republic being a member of this Justice and Development Party, although presidents have to resign their party affiliations, the last stopgap between the full realization of what they believe to be the Justice and Development Party's religious vision for Turkey would be taken away, and Gül would sign all kinds of legislation undermining the secular nature of the Turkish Republic. Again, going back to this cultural secular issue that has dogged Turkey from the very beginning. It turns out that Erdogan called the military's bluff, called for new elections. The Justice and Development Party won 47% of the popular vote, putting the military on the defensive. Justice and Development Party had another with 47% of the vote, an absolute majority in the Turkish parliament. And Gül subsequently became the president of the republic, and a rather successful one. At around the same time, Turkish police found in the basement of an apartment building in a neighborhood of Istanbul a cache of weaponry. Grenades, rifles, automatic weapons, and so on and so forth. And this was revealed to be, allegedly, a plot on the part of military officers currently serving and retired, policemen, intelligence agents, academics, journalists, in this cabal of the alleged, quote-unquote, deep state to foment instability in Turkey that would then encourage the military to step in and take over and reset the political system in a way more to the liking of the officer corps and so on, more closely associated to what had happened before the Justice and Development Party had come to power, which was no panacea. Turkey was extraordinarily unstable before the Justice and Development Party came to power, struggling with financial crisis, struggling with terrible coalition governments. Yet at that period, the Turkish military was the superior and primary political actor in the system. This was what was called the Ergenekon conspiracy. That was in June of 2007, coming shortly after what was called the E-coup attempt, and coinciding with the new election campaign, and coinciding with Abdullah Gül being elected the president of Turkey. Then, in 2008, the prosecutor general of Turkey brought a case against the Justice and Development Party, claiming that the Justice and Development Party was a center of anti-secular activity, threatening to close the Justice and Development Party. This is where these three events are interlocked with that question of secularism and piety, as well as the paranoia of leaders. Erdogan believing that the establishment would never, ever, ever, ever let the Justice and Development Party rule and him to effectively represent the large numbers of people who continue to vote for him. These were all seen as efforts to undermine the AKP, which had met with a tremendous amount of success. The E-coup had failed. The Constitutional Court determined that, in fact, the Justice and Development Party was a center of anti-secular activity, but they didn't have enough votes on the court to actually close the party, and the party was just fine. $20 million, which is like pocket change for the Justice and Development Party at that point. It was like in Erdogan's sock drawer, he could find the $20 million. The Ergenekon conspiracy turned out to be a conspiracy within a conspiracy within a conspiracy, in which the Justice and Development Party, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and importantly, and remember this, because I'm going to come back to it, so there's not going to be a quiz, but please remember it, and the Gülen movement, which is led by a cleric named Fethullah Gülen, who lives in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania, who's a Turk, they were in partnership to go after the military establishment and the establishment in Turkey. That the fact that there was probably, likely, maybe, actually some sort of plot was under, the tables were then turned. The Justice and Development Party, the Gulenists, and their partners turned their tables and went after all of their opponents, both real and perceived. These were all victories for Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party, but they were way too close for comfort. Erdogan determined that he would not allow what happened to the predecessors of the AKP happen to him and his party. There would be no coups. There would be no closure cases. There would be no more consensus building within the Turkish political system. There would only be an effort to crush the opponents of the Justice and Development Party. Out went consensus and compromise that marked the Justice and Development Party's first term. out went the broad coalition that the Justice and Development Party rode to power in 2002 and again in 2007 in favor of a policy of polarization and confrontation with the opposition. Well, what did they do? There's a long, long list of things they do. I will spare you, but I will give you some of the highlights. As I said before, Ergenekon, to which there was something at the beginning, became a conspiracy within a conspiracy to go after the party's opponents. There was a crackdown on the press. Individual journalists were arrested, harassed, and threatened. Actually, today, in February 2017, Turkey is one of the top five jailers of journalists in the world. One of my journalist friends in Turkey, today is his 100th day in prison for doing nothing other than reporting on the activities of the government. There was a crackdown on media companies. Media companies were hounded. The apparatus of the state, the tax authority, was unleashed on what was perceived to be unfriendly media companies in order to intimidate their owners to sell to friendlier owners. This was part of a grand pay-to-play scheme that if you were a big construction conglomerate that wanted to build the new third airport in Istanbul, which no doubt in my mind will be named the Recep Tayyip Erdogan International Airport. If you wanted to lay the concrete for those runways, you had to prove your loyalty. And one of the ways of proving your loyalty was you would buy a media company, and the media outlets that were part of that company, you would change the editorial line to a more friendly line, to the point where now, today, about 80% of the Turkish press is in the hands of either the government or companies that are friendly to the government that will reliably report only what the government wants. This created a virtual ministry of information. In the Arab world, you have ministries of information. Turks did it completely differently. They just forced changes in ownership and intimidated people so that they would report what the government wanted them to. By the time the Gezi Park protests happened in the summer of 2013, you remember these protests in the middle of Istanbul? There's this little park. It's got some trees in it. It's kind of nice. And the government, as part of this pay-to-play scheme, wanted to bulldoze this park and build a mall. Because construction is the way in which you get patronage dollars to flow in Turkey these days. And a big protest happened, to the great surprise of President Erdogan and his advisors. And what was the stunning irony of that protest was not just that it grew to be a very, very large protest, not just that the demands that Turks were expressing during the Gezi Park protests in June 2013 were quite similar to the demands that Egyptians, for example, were expressing in Tahrir Square in January 2011. I was in both places, so I know that they were quite similar. I bet I've had more tear gas than the rest of you. But the stunning irony of this was that in the 10 years prior, 2013 was the 10-year anniversary of the Justice and Development Party coming to power, Erdogan and the party had broadened political participation in Turkey. They had brought more people into politics, encouraged more people to get out there and to vote and be engaged in politics, but it became harder and harder and harder to contest politics in Turkey. You were mobilized, but you were only mobilized for the Justice and Development Party, practically. Yes, of course, there were some opposition parties, but they were weak and feckless and couldn't mount a national campaign. Fast forward from 2013 to 2015. This, to me, is the apotheosis of where Turkey has come to. In June of 2015, there was a national election in Turkey. The Justice and Development Party only won 40% of the vote. The previous election in June 2011, it had won 49.95% of the vote and had an absolute majority in the Turkish Grand National Assembly and could govern alone. With 40% of the vote, It had to form a coalition government. This was a stunning blow to President Erdogan. And what did he do? Did he accept the results? No. He tapped his prime minister, his handpicked prime minister, to go and start coalition government talks with the other parties, while at the same time, he sabotaged those talks, knowing that there was a 45-day clock in order to form a new government. And once those 45 days were up, oh, there'd have to be new elections. And he sabotaged it. 45 days went by, and they declared new elections on November 1, 2015. Guess what the Justice and Development Party won in November 1, 2015? 49.95% of the vote, returning the party to an absolute majority in the Grand National Assembly so the Justice and Development Party could rule alone. All in the service, and this is in the news these days, all in the service of changing the Turkish constitution to fit the ambitions of President Erdogan, who wants to be the president. Now you say, that's weird. He is the president. But he wants to be the president in a different way than he is now. In Turkey, under current conditions, in the current political system, the locus of power runs to the prime minister. The president has a number of important powers, but really the power is exercised by the prime minister. Erdogan, who believes that only he can finish the transformation of Turkey, wants to change the constitution so that he becomes what the Turks are calling the executive president. And over the course of the last month or so, the Grand National Assembly, in keeping with the Justice and Development Party's domination of that body, has made a number of constitutional amendments, which the Turkish people will go vote on in April, that will establish this executive presidency. And already there is a yes-no campaign, and the no people are being met with a tremendous amount of political force. People beaten in the streets, tear gassed, arrested, just for voicing their opposition to this new order. Now, I want to be fair. It is true that under these circumstances, the post-coup environment fits with what's been happening over the course of the last 10 years. And Turkey is as far away from being a democracy than it was in 2003 or 1993 or even 1983 on the heels of another coup d'etat. But there's something different. There's something that's quite different. And there's something that I think is important for people to recognize. There's so much emphasis on this guy, Erdogan. And he is a big personality. He is a charismatic figure. And he is an extraordinary politician. But he is not a tin pot dictator. He's not like the old Tunisian leader who was the first Arab leader to go in the Arab uprisings. Erdogan has a constituency of about half the population that when they think back a decade ago or 15 years ago, they're much, much, much better off than they were. They have more money in their pockets. They have better infrastructure. They have transportation options. They have health care. Erdogan care will not be repealed and replaced. It's there to stay. And importantly, what the Justice and Development Party has done, and this is something getting back to that cultural, religious issue, what they have done is they have made it easier and safer for Turks to explore their religious identities in ways that previously was prohibited and met with public opprobrium. And I always say, if you scratch a Turk, you'll find a good Muslim. There's nothing wrong with that. But in this environment of kind of top-down secularism, it is liberating for Turkish women to wear hijab. And for them, Erdogan doesn't mean autocracy. He means freedom and democracy. And that is what is so difficult in the Turkish political environment. Now, it's so totally polarized. You have half the population says, oh my God, this guy's a crazy authoritarianism. And the other half of the population says, wow, I've never been so free in my life. And I have health care and infrastructure and transportation options and a little bit of money in my pocket. Let me end on two points. Excuse me. What should the United States do about it? What can the United States and the European Union do about it? There isn't much. As I said before, this isn't an international environment that lends itself to an investment in democratic politics. But there's some real practical obstacles to any of those important actors from doing anything. First, the European Union, which had helped drive some of the progressive change in Turkey in 2002, 2003, and 2004, is now at the mercy of the Turks. Why? Because the Turks host 3 million Syrian refugees in its territory and have said to the Europeans, look, if you're going to be more critical of us post-coup, you're not going to give us visa-free travel in the Schengen zone, which is in Europe. We'll unleash all of these people on Europe. Angela Merkel says, no, we'll play ball. This is a very Washington thing to say. I was very critical of the way President Obama handled the Turkey relationship. All that being said, when I think about it, I probably wouldn't have handled it any different from the way President Obama handled it. It's a very one. I was critical because the president never, ever took the opportunity to call out the Turks on some of their more egregious domestic violations of human rights and democratic norms. And there is a reservoir of anti-Americanism in Turkey. And as long as the president of the United States was silent about these issues, it made it easier for President Erdogan and his deputies to continue to hammer away at the United States for all kinds of imagined transgressions against them for their own political gain. And it left us vulnerable to Turkey because, remember, we're in a fight in Syria and Iraq against the Islamic State. And Turkey has a major asset that is important to us. It's called Incirlik Air Base. And it's very, very close to the Syrian border. And we've never thought about alternative options to Incirlik. And we've never been willing to call out the Turks publicly for these violations of these democratic norms as well as just the politeness of being good allies. And thus, we're at the mercy of the Turks when it comes to the use of Incirlik, something that they have brandished. They've said, if the United States isn't going to be more supportive of us against this guy Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the Pocono Mountains, who they want extradited to Turkey, or if the United States isn't going to, if the United States is going to continue to support Syrian Kurds in the fight against ISIS, the Syrian Kurds that we, the Turks, don't like because we consider them to be the same as the terrorists waging a war against us, we'll kick the Americans out of the Incirlik Air Base. This was no way to handle this multifaceted and complex relationship. It remains to be seen what President Trump is going to do about this very, very complicated yet extraordinarily important relationship. President Trump has sent a number of mixed signals about Turkey. The president did speak with President Erdogan the other day. By all measures, it was a good conversation. There were no leaks suggesting otherwise, so we tend to believe that it was. But I think he is going to be confronted with a problem because President Trump has made it a centerpiece of his foreign policy, at least in the early going, or at least what we can tell from his campaign, to, his words not mine, bomb the shit out of ISIS. And to the extent that the Turks have not been willing allies in bombing them out of ISIS, the United States has turned to, as I said before, Syrian Kurds for help doing that. And the Turks don't like the Syrian Kurds because they believe that they are terrorists connected to Turkish Kurdish terrorists. But the Pentagon really likes Syrian Kurds. Somewhere, we're going to have to make a choice. The Obama effort to kind of fudge the two didn't work during President Obama's period, and it's certainly not going to work during the Trump period. So I think that, to end, Turkey's future is clearly authoritarian. Turkey's future is clearly unstable. And the future of U.S.-Turkey relations is clearly uncertain because of our differing priorities with Ankara. I'll stop there. And I'm looking forward to Q&A, which is always my favorite part of these events.
Thank you, and we'll open it up to questions, and we have one over here already. And would you speak very loudly into the microphone, please?
Wait, now I need my glasses.
You began your presentation with identity of the Turks. Ataturk was a European Turk. He changed the alphabet. We all know about these things. Looking forward in the future, is part of that identity that Turkey will become more, quote-unquote, Near Eastern?
I think that's the perennial question that people ask about Turkey. And certainly, as I said at the beginning, Ataturk, for a variety of political reasons, to consolidate his own power, to ensure the survival of this new republic, had to alter the loyalties of the inhabitants of Anatolia from the Ottoman Caliphate, multiculturalism, religion, not that it was great, you know, multiculturalism, to very specific ideas about secularism and Turkishness. That didn't make sense, though, to people who are pious or Kurds. And there has been this ongoing culture war from that founding moment about where pious Turks and Kurds fit in Turkish politics. Now, much to the credit of the Justice and Development Party and President Erdogan is that they have tried to resolve both of those issues up until recently. This was a government that tried harder than other previous governments to resolve that ethnic difference between Turks and Kurds by saying, hey, you're Kurdish, we're Turkish, but we're all good Muslims in Anatolia. That's a basis. If we just relax the idea of Turkishness, maybe we can all just get along. It didn't work out that way because of the exigencies of both Turkish nationalism and Kurdish nationalism that got in the way of those best intentions. But I want to talk about for a second what you said at the end. Is Turkey becoming more Near Eastern, more Middle Eastern? And it's an interesting question because you have this legacy of Ataturk saying, we are going to raise Turkey to the level of civilization. And when he said civilization, he meant Western civilization. And then you have this idea, every time Turkey doesn't do something that is expected of it, people in Washington and elsewhere in Europe and say, well, Turkey's turning to the east. And what I really see is the phenomenon in Turkey is Turkey valorizing Turkey and Turkish history. That when I was living in Ankara and I would talk to young people, or at least they were my, at that time I was young, so, and they would say, I don't know why we have to be either east or west. Why can't we be Turkey? And in fact, the Justice and Development Party actually articulates just that. There is this kind of romanticization, valorization of the Ottoman era that is at the heart of the Justice and Development Party's worldview. They don't see themselves as East or West. They see themselves as a rising Muslim power, as Turkey, as this inheritor of this great civilization. Now, their interpretation of Ottoman history is not at all accurate. And like all good nationalists, they, you know, think of all the best parts of it and try to scrub away the unfortunate aspects of it. But I think that's the key that's going on. And we constantly want to put Turkey in a category. Is it East? Is it West? What is it? In the U.S. government, Turkey's in Europe, but should it be in the Middle East? It's a constant debate. Turkey should be Turkey. And that's the way I think a lot of Turks think about it.
Okay, let's go over here.
There may be a reason for the multiple coups or pseudo-coups. In Ataturk's farewell address to the army, he warned them that they must be on guard to protect Turkey from within and from without. So there was always a constant fear that he had. And my question is, could the army be pushed far enough to really have a coup supported by the people?
It's a great question. And, you know, let me start with your last comment. a coup that could be supported by the people. The big reason why the coup this summer failed was because Turkish society said, no, we don't live in a society where the military steps in. That's the past. We are a much more complex society. Turks have internalized at least the practices and principles of democratic governance, and we no longer live in a society that will support coups. It is true what you said, that Ataturk told the officers that they have this solemn responsibility to protect the government. And then, in fact, in the internal service codes of the Turkish Armed Forces, it says that it is incumbent upon the officers to intervene in politics should they perceive a threat. And that is what in which they have based their periodic interventions in politics. There's two things that have happened that would suggest to me, one, there may not be a coup, and or there's one indicator that would suggest to me there may very well be a coup. I'm a social scientist. I'm not running for anything, so I can do both things. One, those internal service codes were deleted recently as a result of reforms. Two, as I said, Turkish society is complex and differentiated. There isn't anybody, even people, opponents of Erdogan, who look to the military to be their saviors any longer. So that's two reasons mitigating another military intervention. But here's the deal. This is now a military that was once apolitical. It was political in the sense that it arrogated for itself the right to intervene, but it felt that it was above politics. Now, and not just as a result of the failed coup in July, but prior to that, the way in which the Justice and Development Party, after the Ergenekon conspiracy in 2007 and 2008, after that experience, the way in which the party and the leadership sought to control the military was by basically cutting off the head of it and promoting other officers. And what that tends to do, it tends to create factions and loyalties in the military where there weren't before. There were always differences of opinion among Turkish officers. You could sit at a table with four Turkish generals, three three-star generals and a four-star generals, and you know that they disagreed on stuff, but what the four-star general said went. There was a unity of command. I'm not convinced as a result of what started happening in 2007, 2008, and then what happened as a result of the failed coup in July, that this military isn't rife with factions and that something can happen somewhere. They would be stupid to do it because they would be confronted by a society that's really not interested in the military stepping in the same way that Egyptians welcomed the officers back to politics in July 2013. It's a great question, though.
Back Sir. Over here, please.
Yeah, Mr. Cook, that was a great presentation. I really learned a lot.
Oh, good. I'm glad. That's what I'm here for.
Here's my question.
In addition to the great weather.
Would you feel politically comfortable going to Turkey today? Can you go there and walk around and not feel threatened?
Well, do you mean me personally?
Personally, yes.
I am on forced Turkey hiatus.
So the answer is no.
I'm on forced Turkey hiatus.
Thank you.
May we ask why?
I am on forced Turkey hiatus because I guess I'm somewhat of a known quantity in Turkey as a result of what I write and what I say. And because so much of the press is in the hands of pro-government forces, they often don't like any criticism. So I've invariably been called a foreign provocateur, an Islamophobe, the world's leading Islamophobe, Israel's number one lackey in Washington, which is really news to the Israelis, given what I write about Israel. Part of the interest rate lobby, all kinds of things and misrepresentations of my work, which I tend to believe is based on quality research and my training, and I'm not so worried about being arrested at the airport upon entry. What I would be worried about is, and this gives you a sense of the way things have gone in Turkey, is that supporters of the Justice and Development Party will find out where I am and come and beat me up. And then the police will come, and then they'll beat me up some more. And this was brought home to me when my boss, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, was at a meeting in Europe and ran into a common Turkish friend who said to him, listen, Stephen should not go to Turkey for a while. So both my wife and my boss have put me on forced Turkey hiatus.
You're wise and take their advice. Okay, let's go over here, please.
On a more personal basis, we postponed a trip to Istanbul and out in the hinterlands on a fairly lengthy trip, thinking that things might settle down. And I wonder what your assessment is of American tourism, one's personal safety as just another American tourist, and what direction the whole cultural feel is going in terms of maybe anti-Americanism or anti-tourism. In general.
Okay. Marco Rubio moment. You forgot that. I mean, it's been a long time since that, I guess. I would not go. And if I was just, you know, someone who was interested in going to Istanbul, the most beautiful city in Europe, and enjoying the Bosphorus, or going to Cappadocia, or going to Antalya, or Side, or any of these places, the Ilara Valley, I would not go. And that's a very big change for me. I often tell people, go, have a wonderful time, Turks are great. Yes, there is a reservoir of anti-Americanism, but I've never been treated poorly on a person-to-person basis. Forgetting what I just said, now, as I'm a known quantity there, they may not be so nice to me, but in any of my interactions, Turks have been nothing but generous with their time and helpful to me as a tourist. It's just that now Turkey is unstable along a number of dimensions, and you don't want to put yourself in a position where you could get hurt. And I think there's a real possibility of getting hurt in Turkey these days. The Istanbul airport bombing happened last June. In the 11 months prior to that incident, there were 11 terrorist attacks in Turkey. This past December, there were 4 terrorist attacks in 4 weeks, and they've been perpetrated by the PKK, by an offshoot of the PKK, by the Islamic State. The country is unstable along that dimension, as well as this crazy kind of politics. So I think it's worthwhile for anybody who's thinking about a trip to postpone for at least a little bit until they get a sense of the way things are.
So just a quick follow-up. You wouldn't even think it's safe to go to Istanbul for a short trip just to see the city?
You're going to go in Istanbul to the Blue Mosque and the Hagia Sophia. Those are prime targets for the Islamic State.
Over here.
Yeah, at no point did Mr. Putin's name cross your lips. What about Turkey's relationship and Erdogan's relationship with Mr. Putin, and where's that going to go? How's that dance going to play out?
Yeah, everybody wants to talk about Vladimir Putin these days, especially since he's been getting such a great role on Saturday Night Live. people want to make a really big deal of the Erdogan-Putin relationship, and one of my colleagues and friends has written eloquently about the kind of bromance between Erdogan and Putin and how Erdogan has modeled himself in ways after Putin. I think that there's something to the idea of a Russian-Turkish rapprochement, but I think it's also limited. I think that if you look at who's been purged in Turkey from the military, it's officers who've served in NATO, it's officers who have been trained in the United States. And what you have a rise of in the armed forces, as well as in other important parts of Turkey, is a rise of the Eurasianists, who neither see the European Union nor the bilateral relationship with the United States as Turkey's future. And that, in keeping with the idea of being Turkish nationalists, maybe they would be better off developing better ties with the Russians. I think there's a couple of problems with it. And then there's a real practical explanation for why Erdogan went to dinner in Moscow with President Putin. So I think the two obstacles to this, and certainly I'm not denying that there isn't this pull, but the first one is the Russians have been beating up on the Turks for like 600 years, and the Turks are unnerved by the Russians. When the Russians took over Crimea, Crimea used to be an Ottoman territory, and the Turks got sort of upset, you know, very quietly, despite their unhappiness, perennial unhappiness with NATO. The Turks were begging for stepped-up NATO patrols over the Black Sea. The second obstacle is, although it's worth some research to see whether these things are loosening, is that whatever difficulties Turkey is having in its relations, political and diplomatic relations with the West, it's anchored to the West by trade flows, financial flows, all kinds of things. If you ask my friends who are bankers in New York, they say, well, you know, Turkey might as well be part of the European Union just based on that. Now, there's a question in this post-failed coup environment whether that will continue. Will foreign direct investment continue to go into Turkey in a variety of different ways if, in this post-coup environment, your business partner can look at someone the wrong way and be accused of being a Gulenist and disappear into a Turkish jail with no recourse and your business, your investment be seized? That's a problem. So we'll have to see, but I still think that this idea of economics and so on and so forth is kind of an obstacle to the full flowering of a Turkish-Russian strategic relationship. And finally, the practical reason why Erdogan has made nice with Putin, besides the fact that Putin put the screws to him after the Turks shot down that Russian airplane, was the fact that the United States has written itself out of the conflict in Syria. President Obama wanted to have nothing to do with the conflict in Syria. President Trump seems to want to make a deal with the Russians and the Iranians and the Assad regime that will leave President Assad in place. The Russians will take care of the opposition to Assad, where the Americans focus their firepower on the Islamic State. And in that environment, the one address where Turkey has to go in order to ensure its interests in Syria is Moscow. And what is Turkey's interest in Syria? It's preventing the Syrian Kurds from establishing an autonomous quasi-state along Turkey's southern border. Because the main Syrian Kurdish party and fighting force is connected to the PKK, the Turkish Kurdistan Workers Party, which has been waging a war against the Turkish state since Donald Trump was married to Ivana. So that is why Erdogan showed up in Moscow.
Okay, and back over here.
What's your best guess if some weird event happened and Erdogan lost his next re-election?
I think it's probably more likely that Erdogan dies. Now, I'm not saying I want him to die. I'm saying it's more likely that Erdogan dies than he loses the next election. After all, as I pointed out, in June 2015, Erdogan essentially lost. I mean, if you are tracking the Justice and Development Party and its electoral tallies since 2007, 40% of the vote, which is a lot better than the other parties, is a win, but it's a loss for the Justice and Development Party. It meant the loss of their parliamentary majority. And so he used the political institutions of the state and manipulated them in a way to get the outcome that he liked. That's what I would expect from the Justice and Development Party and President Erdogan going forward. And in fact, the way in which they went about, you know, changing the Constitution reflects the fact that they have no regard for democratic norms and principles. So I think it's unlikely that he's going to lose. Everybody keeps looking at, oh, well, the economy isn't doing well. And in fact, the economy really isn't doing well. But he has already insulated himself from criticism of responsibility for Turkey's economic crash. Going back to 2013, during those Gezi Park protests that I participated in, it was not an accident that he was calling people the interest rate lobby. That was not just that wasn't just a slur that came from nowhere. This coincided with chatter within the U.S. Federal Reserve that the United States would end quantitative easing, which is a fancy way of saying really low interest rates. And so if the United States ended quantitative easing, you'd have an increase in interest rates in Turkey, which in a country with a large current account deficit, relies on foreign direct investment, relies on hot money coming in. Low interest rates have been a boon to Turkish growth, have been a boon to that increasing Turkish middle class that has all of those things that I enumerated before. You have to insulate yourself from these things, and so you start calling people the interest rate lobby and international bankers who want to bring Turkey to its knees, and you portray yourself as a defender of Turkey and a defender of that growth and defender of the middle class who come out in the hundreds of thousands to support you.
And on that, we thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you all very much.